Historical Field,
The History of Christianity and a Biography of the Present Pope, John Paul. And he's been an editor of the New Statesman, the London Statesman. I can remember taking that when we were in Norway back in 58, and the front page of it said, "How did the Christian Church lose Africa?" And that's one of my jokes I tell once in a while. Because, boy, if anything hasn't worked out that way, it's that. It looked like it then, and it's been anything but that since. It's about the one place where we've had any success in a period of time as far as the church goes. But it's possible to be way off sometimes. One of the fun things that we'll see that he makes at the end is that all these predictions of the death of religion in the century and the death of God, and he says that's the great nun fact of our particular time, modern times. It costs a lot of money, but if you order it from Luther Seminary, it takes a little while because they keep ordering new copies. It's really been selling like hotcakes, in spite of, even from them, it costs $20 plus the Minnesota tax on books, but the other price is $30. But it's a lot of book, and it'll take a while reading it, so take care of anything else you spend money on for a while. And it's worth reading and rereading. I've only read it twice, and I plan to read it again and read portions aloud. There are parts which, of course, affect me with some violence and response, but I appreciate his concern all the way through, and we'll talk to that before we're through. I'll say just in general, it's been on the best-selling list. It's a recommended list from New York Times for nonfiction for this last year. Dan said that he doesn't think he would be able to interpret the news without it. It's meant that much for his reading, and he's a fellow Lutheran layman, with some of you who are Lutherans. And it gives whole new insights in the present picture and what's happening, and maybe a different stance, too, on some things. I would like to just say before I begin, and as we're meeting here, if I'd had more time up here, I would like to take for a little while in Martin Heidegger, because you tend to get afraid of even the word philosophy sometimes, and without realizing it, you're talking him and thinking of him a lot, and this place is built in order to understand him, and especially as he finally sees that it's the poetry and the poetic image that finally communicates the meaning of being to us above all, as we are relating to Jesus Christ. And he's a good Lutheran, despite being a Roman Catholic. After I talk Martin Luther's theology for a whole year, and it really comes through strong in him. And this whole meaning of one of the great words we've dealt with a lot here in my time, that word when Paul says, "Let your MDA case be known to all men," in Philippians 4. And that word cannot be translated to English, because in the Greek world it's only used for gods and kings. We don't happen to have either in our American society. And the best translation, I think, is the New English, because of what Winston Churchill has made of that word in Victory Magnanimity, as Churchill said, and the word magnanimous is great. Great soul, great spirited. Let everybody know your great soul, your great spiritness. And I think that comes through very strongly with John and Mary Schramm and their leadership, so I repeat it again, because this is what Heidegger is concerned for, that this happens in our life. So we live with astonishment, as he puts the word, and living overnight with Fritz, who always astonishes me, and how sometimes when we get after midnight, which we didn't get that far this time, he'll start quoting poetry by the reams and reams of it, just pours out that he knows by heart, but always with that sense of astonishment in him that comes through. It's like an 18-year-old just getting ready for college, excited about everything. And not bad on your 72nd birthday to be that, you know. I wish for all of you that kind of a 72nd year. But Heidegger will help on that. You live in him without realizing. We are in what he calls the thrownness, the geworfenheit of our times. We are without roots, and as rootless people, some very strange things can happen unless we take time to let our language speak to us, because we are language, and literally language speaks through us. We don't only speak it speaks to us, and what's happening then is what happens to us, and the need of time and quiet simply to let that happen. So that in the words of Paul Ricoeur, language becomes a happening. And this has been my particular philosopher, because if I had known him while I was still at the seminary, they never would have been able to kick me out of the seminary. I got kicked out of seminary because guys were converted in my class and accused me of evangelizing. And my defense was, no, I just wasn't teaching as if Jesus Christ were someplace else, that's all. And that does make a difference a little bit. That's Paul Ricoeur's point. And he's arguing for what he calls a non-ostensive exegesis. That you own the text as you're reading it. You own this lecture as it's being heard. It's coming to you, you make it yours. You respond to it, it becomes yours. It isn't the way that I will even be understanding that you necessarily need to. You've got to understand in terms of things that you already know. After all, and by the laws of apprehension, your own life. And so it becomes yours, and you go out with it. Nobody goes out with the same village, we used to say. Everybody's here goes out with another holding, because they have to go out with what they came in, plus what's happened here. But hopefully nobody is ever going to be the same for having been here. And this is what Ricoeur sees. In the context, then, of exegesis, he sees the total context of our life. That as you're reading the text of the scripture speaking through the whole context of everything that we are, including the life context that we're in. He got this not least from a philosopher named Husserl, and it's an exciting man who teaches both at Chicago and at Paris, and I view him as perhaps the best mind dealing with the Christian faith and revelation in our time at this moment. And I love what he has to say all the way through. And it applies to what you're going to read now in modern times, because this is over against some of these things. He's writing in the same age that these men are writing, and out of the same kinds of a conviction. These are all men who've been gripped by something bigger than they are, namely our Lord Jesus Christ, who has laid hold of them with a new meaning and the possibility of newness. And he is very much right in tune with this book, Modern Times, as he closes these little essays that have been selected and published by Fortress Press, our LCA friends. And he says just this in conclusion, which I think will resonate with some degree of empathy and sympathy in you people. He said, to put it in a few words, here's his summing up what he's been saying. The true malice of man appears only in the state and in the church. As institutions of gathering together, of recapitulation, of totalization. As they think they've got it made. The church thinks it's the kingdom. Bishops can't help it. That's part of their job. And as a consequence, a lot of confusion happens. See? I love Dave Preuss. He's a friend of this place. First person I wrote to for anything after I came up here in a miserable summer. We were locked out, weren't even allowed to come in and eat with everybody because you don't interrupt the eating, so I and my family were outside. But as I told Gilbert, don't keep paying guests out there, because there were some paying guests with us, and we finally got in through another door. But that's our introduction to the village as we came up, soaking wet from a boat that was already leaking, and it rained all summer, and there was no place to go. No, we were in the process of doing, there was no place that was warm. So I just wrote a letter to Dave Price, said, you get things done, we need two stoves up here, these ordinary cheapies to throw some wood into. And the next mail back, I've got the money, and we get them, you know, because he's guessing it. So I can tell the story. And he's been a good friend of this place. But Dave paid for my way to go with Paul Bowe over to Sioux Falls, because I'm used to prison, and I thought Paul wasn't. And Paul's very conservative. He'd make President Ford look like a radical, generally speaking. And he's going to go to jail for being at Wounded Knee. And they're under fire, and he won't give the names of the people. He didn't happen to give communion or hear confession, they claimed. So therefore, he wasn't a pastor. And so I got the law of South Dakota changed after that. And it's changed in this way, that the church determines the privacy of the situation as the gospel has shaped it, not where you happen to sit and what you're waving in your hand. But they had made a nice little cross for him. And I said, why don't you wave that in front of the grand jury? I'm sure some of my members from Watertown were on it. And that would have proved to them that you were there as a churchman and a Christian. But anyway, Dave said, and complained about his, he says, you've got to be there, you're his friend. But he says, I don't understand, Paul. Why can't he deal with the good Indians? Why does he have to deal with these bad Indians? And I said, Dave, he's got a lousy example. And Dave didn't smile. We got to Sioux Falls, and Stavig is me. Stavig's an old friend, one of my prophets for me that I could talk about like the kids did last night. Been a terrific person in my life. And Stavig is the same note with Dave. Dave Preuss tells him, yeah, we've got good Indians, Paul. Why don't you deal with the good Indians? And I said to both of them again, can't you realize he's got a terrible example? And they laughed again. Because everybody knows Jesus came for the good people. So this is the problem of institutions. They do this to you. They do this to you. Yep.
Before you leave Heidegger, I wonder if you'd make some comment about his politics.
Well, that's a mess, and I think you should read it in order to get the whole picture. No, he never tried to defend himself. He wasn't allowed to teach by our armed forces from 45 to 51 because back in 39, he, along with some other people like Kittle, of this big Kittle Greek dictionary and so on, had backed up Hitler and the Nazi movement as he thought a chance to purify the German language and so on. And that's what you're asking about.
But the philosopher whom you mentioned just a few minutes ago, Husserl, Heidegger was responsible for having him dismissed from his post simply on the grounds that he was Jewish.
Well, there was more to that than that, but that's true. Husserl wasn't just Jewish, he was also Lutheran, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's one of those strange sorts of things, yeah. Now, he's bringing up a conflict situation I wasn't going to go into, and I won't because it's bigger, but let's put it this way, that one of the great spirits, and she sure is, Hannah Arendt, was all for him, and Hannah Arendt is Jewish. And she feels he's the mind of our times, and if you don't know Heidegger, you don't know what's happening in your century. That's all I can say. And she knows the whole story, and she's Jewish herself, and is part of
the whole story of the Husserl.
Well, as far as it's known, yeah. And she's still, I mean, he's a human being with flesh and blood like the rest of us, I suppose. And one thing certainly our Lutherans learned is that if you want protection in time the church is under attack, don't depend on your church council. Expect somebody who hasn't gone to church to put his neck out and risk his life in order to save you from the forces and get you over the border to Switzerland, which happened again and again and again.
Yeah.
While members of the church constantly paid the pastor to the Nazis for something he said in a sermon. No, this is, I want to read a little bit more on this from him when we're on this. He's just saying this, that these two institutions, because they claim to have arrived in a peculiar way, defeat anything breaking through that's new. And so they become the enemy of the kingdom breakthrough. And he says, thus understood, and in his work on radical evil, incidentally, he's done an excellent job. We had that book up when I was here, and that's where he realized that freedom really springs from our knowledge of radical evil for him as a philosopher. His book on Freud reads like a novel, and it's been stolen from the Seattle Library now, so I couldn't reread it. But it's one which you can get around from libraries, very well done on, where he does affirm Freud is in his real affirmation of the radical evil again. Thus understood, the doctrine of radical evil can furnish a receptive structure for new figures of alienation, besides the speculative illusion or even the desire for consolation, of alienation in the cultural powers, such as the church and the state. It is indeed at the heart of these powers that a falsified expression of the synthesis can take place. When Kant speaks of servile faith, a false cult, of a false church, he completes at the same time his theory of radical evil. This culminates, we might say, not with transgression, that is, not with these external moralities, but with flawed synthesis in the political and religious spheres. That is why true religion is always in a debate with false religion, that is, for Kant's statutory religion. When I was in charge of the youth movement in the ELC, I always said everywhere, the kids, you can't be a Christian without the church, you can't baptize yourself, and you can't stay one without fighting it. And I one time put a little bit stronger than that, without hating it, and Marsdale was driving, was a bishop in Canada, and he stopped the car, he was so mad, and Agnew Tanner smoked his pipe and broke it laughing, and we had a little discussion. And then when the church knocked out evangelism, Mars probably had a breakdown. I never saw anybody grow old so fast, because if the church could, knock out evangelism, he had a confusion between church and kingdom, like bishops tend to get. And always institutionalizing has this problem, you see. Al Roggins wrote a cute thing for my 70th little birthday to me. He said that those of us who are innovators always have to suffer from those who are the ones who sustain and maintain, because you've all got more than you want to handle already, and here comes somebody with something new, and that's an administrative problem. And the best way to get rid of it is to get rid of the guy, naturally. But then you allow him to be someplace where it takes half a day to get there, because if people are fool enough to go, they deserve what happens to them. Well, that prepares you for this, because what his argument here is, that the backside says here, throughout these years, the power of the state to do evil expanded with awesome speed its power to do good grew slowly and ambiguously. Now that's put as kindly as any statement he's made in here. Its power to do good grew slowly and ambiguously. The power was there. I always think of the 30s. We never gave a dollar to anybody that they didn't earn, except the bankers, Reconstruction Finance Corporation. But otherwise, the students earned for their money on their student loans, you know, they worked for it. The CCC was a great thing. WPA, another great thing. But the first time the arts and the theater ever got a subsidy from the government or anything, Al Cui used to say that the whole educational process, including the arts and the theater, get 1/8 of 1 cent of our budget in percentage. He was over that particular committee and he used to just grind them, because that's where we're at in American democracy. We don't support the theater and the arts and so on as the government goes. But we have money for other things. But the problem of the government to do good. Now back in the Depression days, out of that came a lot of supports in that thing, but everybody worked. I mean, they used to argue about, WPA had something to do with won't work or something like that, that people would say, and there were a lot of people made fun, but boy, it's terrific when you go around and see all these nice post offices and murals and so on, and forests and state parks and bridges. And the ecology thing for the first time came into our national bloodstream with the CCC movement. So things can happen that way again and haven't yet, but the state can do. So there are its power, as he says, to do good rule slowly and ambiguously. I have to say this much, because by and large through this, you'll see much stronger statements. And I won't go into it all. I'm hoping just to get you to read it, just by the little that I do here now. I just want to take a summaric statement here as we begin. The destructive capacity of the individual, however vicious, is small. Of the state, however well-intentioned, almost limitless. Expand the state, and that destructive capacity necessarily expands too. Pari passu. I remember getting in trouble with the chairman of my board of deacons in Iowa, in Clerica. He came up curious after that I should say that America had sinned. And I said, John, do I sin? Well, that wasn't hard for him to say yes to. And he even meant he did. Together we don't. I said, together, unfortunately, we do worse. I said, if you want to really see sinning at its worst, see a seminary faculty in action, is why I say it now. I hadn't been on one yet. But you know, and this was developed, of course, into theology by a man by the name of Reinhold Niebuhr. But where you see it at its worst is at its best. And in community, we can do far worse things. That's why, during my time, for better or worse, everybody went out of the village under pressure, went out only from me, so they would continue to hate me. I still get hate mail on it, but the village wasn't hated. I was the one that was wrong. When, for instance, they take a hike up over the mountains and come back in the deep of night, and we have 55 guys up there risking their life hunting for them. And the next morning, of course, when the bus went, they went. And I loved Grandma. I still love her. She doesn't know that, but I did. But I loved her enough to keep our word. We don't do those things in a community. Well, this kind of capacity of the community to do evil is what he's developing here at the expense of the individual and his own responsibility, his own sense of conscience. And he, as he goes on to say, the effect of the Great War was enormously to increase the size and therefore the destructive capacity and propensity to oppress of the state. A little small way, Orwell saw it coming. And there's an essay up here in a book that Paul has, because Nancy Winter wants to use it for a reading group on literature and what it means, and that there can be no literature except by fighting the church and the state. He uses the church here as Catholicism, and the state, whether it's communism or the national government of Britain. That for the individual, being individual is all to be put down, you're individualistic. But that's the only way truth breaks through. It has to be your truth that speaks in order to make a literature that's worth reading. That's Orwell's argument. And he feels that this is what we have not seen. I would say that as I read this, there were lines that came to me that have been with me since a freshman at college. When I went to college, I was a very convinced socialist. And even at the seminary, I was still a socialist, and we had our own party with Claire de Lune as our national hymn. And, But we did vote it, in spite of some feeling. But this little poem really summed up my feelings very much. They will break the world in twain when their hands are on the rein. It's by Margaret Whittemer. What is that to me, says God? You've only taught the darkness you have known. And you feel this as you read this book. What have we done? Andy, my son, just came back. He's been in Africa for 4 years. He came back for a brief surprise because I didn't know he was there. I thought it was Paul, growing a beard quick. They looked a lot alike. Until he opened his mouth and said, I did it for $500, and then I knew it was Andy. And he said, there's no way we can win. The black hates the white. And we have to face that objectively before we're gonna do anything that's in any way valid in the situation. And he says, this is why there's no use for either World Council or Lutheran World Federation as it affects the African situation. That it remains a fundamental fact. The world, the way it sits right now. And we'll see some of it here, and we'll see some of his defense of the white in here, in the picture, so far as it can be, as you read it. I want to start a little bit where he starts. He begins with Einstein, this particular period of time, 23, when finally, to Einstein's satisfaction, the theory of relativity was proved by the third incident. He refused to accept it was a possibility as long as that couldn't happen. He says about Einstein's care, and his concern in this, so that it was, he said, from that time onward, Einstein was a global hero in demand at every great university in the world, mobbed wherever he went, his wistful features familiar to hundreds of millions, the archetype of the abstracted natural philosopher. The impact of his theory was immediate and cumulatively immeasurable, but it was to illustrate what Karl Popper was later to term. Karl Popper is a Viennese philosopher, by the way, and worth reading. I haven't read him, but I like everything I've read about him. The law of unintended consequence. Because suddenly this theory of relativity becomes introduced in an area where Einstein is appalled, and it's applied to morals, to politics, to values, to truth. And so we're in a period of relativity. And this becomes, as he goes on to say, he says, no one is more distressed than Einstein by this public misapprehension. He was bewildered by the relentless publicity and error which his work seemed to promote. He wrote to his colleague, Max Born, on 9th of September, 1920, like a man in the fairy tale who turned everything he touched into gold, so with me everything turns into a fuss in the newspapers. Einstein was not a practicing Jew, but he acknowledged a God. He believed passionately in absolute standards of right and wrong. His professional life was devoted to the quest not only for truth, but for certitude. He insisted that the world could be divided into subjective and objective spheres, and that one must be able to make precise statements about the objective portion. In the scientific, not the philosophical sense, he was an indeterminist. In the 1920s, he found the indeterminacy principle of quantum mechanics not only unacceptable, but abhorrent. For the rest of his life, until his death in 1955, he sought to refute it by trying to anchor physics in unified field theory. He wrote to Born, you believe in a God who plays dice and I in complete law and order in a world which objectively exists, in which I, in a wild speculative way, am trying to capture. I firmly believe, but I hope that someone will discover a more realistic way, or rather more tangible basis than it has been my lot to find. But Einstein failed to produce a unified theory either in the 1920s or thereafter. He lived to see a moral relativism, to him a disease, become a social pandemic, just as he lived to see his fatal equation bring into existence nuclear warfare. There were times, he said, at the end of his life when he wished he'd been a simple watchmaker. Hurts. It hurts, doesn't it? Then, as he said, as this went on, it formed a knife. So the public response to relativity was one of the principal formative influences on the course of 20th century history. It formed a knife inadvertently wielded by its author to help cut society adrift from its traditional moorings in the faith and morals of Judea Christian culture. And he's going to show this very clearly as he goes through. I might say on Einstein unified field theory, Niels Bohr, the other big shot in this whole thing, of course, held opposite point of view. And as my best theologian has understood them, I think, and analyzed them correctly, her name happens to be Mary, She's my wife, and she's from whom I get most of my theology. She said, Einstein's problem is he was formed by Hero Israel, the Lord thy God is one God, and Niels Bohr was formed by catechism, and he knew that there is no truth that is not two truths, and so this is what their argument was all the time, the two statements. And Niels Bohr, and he spent the last year of his life running all over preaching the theory of complementarity, which of course makes room for the kind of evangelical faith that we know and love too, and the need of two statements. He said it from the nature of light. You can't understand light without two statements, which don't, they just don't come together, but need two statements. And he always kidded Einstein, this is never going to come off. Wasting time. But anyway, this relativity then mixes up, as he says, with Freud, unfortunately. Gets right into it. The impact was especially powerful because it virtually coincided with the public reception of Freudianism. And then he goes into this where it's at, and I would suggest this issue of Atlantic Monthly is being required reading for all of you to realize how this thing has really gotten a real shot down from its own area of experts. And I'm very grateful for the article. It's a terrific thing. It makes you sick for the integrity of medicine, actually. But it shows how Einstein got led by the nose. I mean, that Freud got led by the nose into it. The fun thing about him saying here is new to me. He says, the one major novelist that saw through both Freud and Marx, because then he goes on to get mixed up Marx, and these three go together to determine our period of time he's going to discuss. And he said that was Conrad, Joseph Conrad. And so I went and got Victory and Under Western Skies out and saw how true it was. Conrad did. He saw the need them took. But here he quotes what then became sort of the prevailing kind of thinking. And he quotes Sergei Diaghilev of the Polis Russiae. And this is the sort of formative demonic image that you've got operative in our times. It's behind this whole thing that you here have been so ardently opposing. We are witnesses of the greatest moment of summing up in history, in the name of a new and unknown culture which will be created by us and which will also sweep us away. That is why, without fear or misgiving, I raise my glass to the ruined walls of the beautiful palaces, as well as to the new commandments of a new aesthetic. The only wish that I, an incorrigible centralist, can express is that the forthcoming struggle should not damage the amenities of life, and that the death should be as beautiful and as illuminating as the resurrection. The complete nihilism of destruction. Lilia said to me once, you don't know how lucky you are, Carolina, with youth that have in no way been subject to it. See, this has been the mood of the European continent. It's over. Let's celebrate the last big thing before it all goes under. See? And that's why he quotes this from the Russian, the ballet specialist, and so on. But he brings in Marx and how it goes together in this whole kind of destructive thinking of man, so that man himself does not exist except as classes. And that's why we can have what we're looking at in our daily newspapers and what's happening in Central America, this destructive of your own fellow citizens, because it's a class you're destroying. You're destroying not people, not persons, but a class. And he goes and he'll show this time after time as he moves through the history of this period of time. He mentions Freud's big thing was a kind of guilt that belonged to everybody, so forget about your personal one. None of us were individually guilty. We were all guilty. And so that got rid of the personal responsibility for your own. It all got subsumed. And as he says, for Conrad, the war merely confirmed the irremediable nature of man's predicament. and he could see through both Marx's malevolent nonsense, certain to generate monstrous tyranny, and Freud's ideas were nothing more than a kind of magic show. The heartsick thing you feel about Marx is at one thing has come out very clearly right now, since several novels I've been reading lately, and has been in some articles even. At 17, for his graduation from what they have as kind of like junior college, his paper was on Christ as the only hope of the world, and why. And you ask, what happened to him? So he went into the other. Did he get, this is one claim now from the Roman Catholic Jesuits, that he got involved in actual satanic worship with that particular group that he got involved in far out gang in Berlin as he went on his university. I don't know. I doubt that myself. But he did get to where he actually could glory simply in a kind of malevolent destruction, out of which he believed could be born the new, of course. But to destroy everything to have the new come, and the new has a way of becoming worse than the old. Well, this particular discussion then, as we go through, points up that history is the hope of history, really. And it may be true, as Heidegger says, that perhaps it's for a Europe that history is now passed by and been given over to Russia and America, which has robbed the techne of its Greek meaning of art and even poetry, and so it becomes merely technology, and man becomes simply a servant of his own technology and no longer the person in possession of his soul, that maybe Europe, because it's got some time, might have time to restore it. And sometimes I wonder if sometimes some of these seminal thinking, like Heidegger and to me, this Paul Ricoeur, darling, one of my young friends who happens to be a very committed anarchist, was at dinner with him in New York 2 years ago, and he says his eyes just simply glow with life. He says he's just alive. And you have that feeling that he's caught the astonishment that Heidegger speaks about as he's writing. So they're worth tackling a little bit. And this Paul Johnson now is writing as a Roman Catholic thinker. He doesn't say this. One should say this to begin with. There are two doctrines, both of which I have a lot of trouble with, and I've spent a lot of time with it in my life in research, where they came from and why they got to be. He believes in a natural law that actually should substantiate and make possible some kind of common decent behavior. I wished I did. My own understanding of Becker and of anthropology makes it impossible for me. And I don't believe in the Lutheran doctrine of the two kingdoms on the other side. That's the other way of kind of getting where you have the feeling nothing's going to happen because the kingdom on the left is always going to be brutal and by force, and there's no hope for anything else. Marvelous article by a new bishop who's been here quite frequently since John's been here, Erdal, ends with a note of hope that maybe the church may catch up with the fact that God isn't through with us in this history, and it's a possibility to think something soberly about even the matter of war, and that it isn't necessary any more than rape as a solution for relationships. And it's a good article. It made me think that in 1897, the old synod amongst us Norwegians, we had 17 synods, by the way, the old synod related to the Missouri Synod, and their meeting in Alexandria, 1897, I hope you got the date, had as one of its resolutions that slavery is okay. The Bible showed that. One of my heroes happened to be a member of that synod. I was to inherit his library, but I was in prison when his daughter died. I managed to get some remnants of it later. He left his whole property. He left to the church. It's now actually a retirement home of our ALC in Alexandria, Minnesota. But he never went back to church after that. Senator Knut Nelson of Minnesota, one of our Norske heroes, who used to make every little talk that he gave in the Senate start with, democracy did not start with the American Revolution. Iceland had it in the year 1000. But the tragedy of the church is in that resolution of 1897. I just heard a man really weeping over Namibia, and I said, don't you realize that because he didn't bring it up, the original motion for apartheid in South Africa was made well, one of the dear, marvelous people who's meant much to me. I have memorized this book on prayer, along with prayer by Hollisby. It's the two greatest books of prayer I know, and it's shaped much of my life, with Christ in the School of Prayer, Andrew Murray. Andrew Murray made the motion for the Constitution of South Africa for apartheid. So piety does not save you from this kind of thing. And being in the church doesn't. Carnes over here, good staunch member of the old synod, and a strong, intelligent group of people. We just buried one of its prophets at 102, a dear lover of this place, another Preuss, J.C.K., terrific people, and yet the church can do these things, see? That's why it says it, because it thinks it's sort of arrived at something by which it can final absolute notions. There are always going to be wars and rumors of wars. Why are you talking about it? Jesus said, the poor you always have with you. Why are you voting socialist, you know? Well, there wasn't reason not to. There are other better reasons not to, finally, because we don't have angels to be the bureaucrats. It's the best reason not to. But I want to read something here to give you an idea of how it's going to be shocking to somebody. And that's why I'm reading this, because then I'll get you reading it, because we want to go on to Vespers fairly soon. It is a myth that European youth was ruthlessly sacrificed in 1914 by selfish and cynical age. Just given a sweatshirt to Leo Busted, and Fritz had one for his birthday, and a big picture they made. All his neighbors had a big blow-up picture of it. That, oh, age and treachery can win over youth and skill. Anyway. It is a myth that European youth was ruthlessly sacrificed in 1914 by selfish and cynical age. The speeches of pre-war politicians were crammed with appeals to youth. Youth movements were a European phenomenon, especially in Germany, where 25,000 members of the Wandervogel clubs hiked, strummed guitars, protested against pollution and the growth of cities, and damned the old. Opinion formers like Max Weber and Arnold Miller von der Brück demanded that youth be brought to the helm. The nation, wrote Brook, needs a change of blood, an insurrection of the sons against the fathers, a substitution of the old by the young. You know, just like you replace men with women and we'll have no more wars. I was reading that from Gandhi, sort of, and I thought, yes, and it was true. A certain gal in England did not want anything to do with the Falklands, but insisted rather they build another island and give it to the Spaniards. Don't you wish you had? All over Europe, sociologists were assiduously studying youth to find out what it thought and wanted. Of course what youth wanted was war. The first pampered youth generation went enthusiastic to war with their elders. If you want to see that in a terrific novel, read Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann, by the way. Went enthusiastic to war with their elders, almost without exception, accepted with horror or fatalistic despair. Among articulate middle-class youth, it was at the outset at least the most popular war in history. They dropped their guitars and seized their rifles. Charles Peguy, one of the beautiful guys and a hero for both Mary and myself, and one of our great scholars, Jerry Pelican, told me once, the Missouri Synod gets too hot for me, fine, I'm going to drop out and join the Catholic Church in France, because it's at least having a revival. And Charles Peguy is the head of that revival. But here Charles Peguy wrote that he went eagerly to the front and death. Henry D. Montfleur reported that he loved life at the front, the bath and the elemental, the annihilation of the intelligence and the heart. That's just the way Magic Mountain ends, with lines, just like that, as he lies with his face in the mud. Pierre Drew de la Chaux called the war a marvelous surprise. Young German writers like Walter Flex, Ernest Wook, and Ernst Junger simply stayed with a whole mess under Hitler so he could recover and help redeem the German language after it had been destroyed by Hitler. And one of our beautiful Lutheran Christians in a novel, for one of his novels I like, but he wrote, called it the holy moment of August 1914. The novelist Fritz van Anger described the war as a purgative, the beginning of a new zest for life. Rupert Brooke, think of the hymns we got from him, a whole hymn book in the Cambridge one. Rupert Brooke found it the only life, a fine thrill like nothing else in the world. For Robert Nichols, it was a privilege. He is dead who will not fight, wrote Julian Grenfell, into battle, and who dies fighting has increased. Young Italians who got into the war later were, if anything, even more lyrical. This is the hour of triumph of the finest values, one Italian poet wrote. This is the hour of youth. Another echoed, only the small men and the old men of 20 would want to miss it. It'll be a shocker to you as you go through, because it will review a few things, and he adds, he always gives his material, plenty of material to fortify his summary there. As he says, as it went on, it became a horror, and one of our best and favorite movies here, which has been treated to us by the kitchen crew on occasion, is that jolly one, which, what kind of a symbol do they use each time so many die? In that jolly World War I?
Oh, what a lovely war.
Yeah, I know, oh, what a lovely war, but what's the symbol they use? They don't show the dead, they show something else.
Oh, a poppy.
Oh, poppy, yeah, another poppy. All the way through. Anyway, it's part of the horrors we know, our memories. with us. And then we get World War II afterwards, thinking it's impossible after that. And I was a pacifist, so was Ricky, and I would have done the same thing as Ricky, I'm sure, had I been in the same kind of a situation where I was. I didn't have a choice. He went the next morning after Pearl Harbor and joined, and it was 2 weeks later he was in Burma practically. And it's tough from these, when your country's under attack, to find any keep with it. Howie Hong's the only one I know of my particular buddies who stayed a really belligerent pacifist through World War II. But to hold onto that in this kind of world, which is it is at, and which so oftentimes it isn't our fight or our war, we get dragged into it. He writes it up here in a good, interesting way. Anyway, Paul, would you like to add from your thinking? Because it's about it, I think, from my not saying too much more, just so you get going. Just that much should give you some feeling that you're going to get a little turnabout in your points of view as you go through it. You're going to discover some good reasons for thinking Ike's the best president we ever had. This is from an Englishman. I voted for Ike because a fellow as president who had so much time to play golf, I thought it was great. And maybe some of our preachers wouldn't take themselves so seriously either and would start playing golf. And their sermons would improve. But he shows that it's one of the best presidents we've had because he worked his head off after midnight and was on the phone. And the guys he had out thinking they'd done the job, he'd prepared the way ahead of time. And it's true, we had the biggest prosperity and a time of peace during that time. And he, remember, went over and personally saw to it that we got out of Korea right after his election. Incidentally, Ike's good friend was Fritz's brother, Lal Norstedt, and they were very close. So there's a lot more in him than what meets you in terms of, he said, even the Ike speech, he could speak differently. He purposely took that kind of form in order to hide his thoughts, which did a good job to the public. But you get a new insight in many ways. But at the same time that he says this, it was at this point that Eisenhower's customary good sense failed him. Indeed, it can be argued that he's more responsible for the eventual mess in Vietnam than any other American. He should have signed the accords and compelled the premier of the South, Ngo Dinh Diem, to abide by them. It is possible Ho would have won free elections and become ruler of a united communist country. Would that have been a disaster for America? Even Atkinson, in his famous perimeter speech of January 1950, had not considered a non-communist government in Indochina essential to American security. George Kennan, in a memo dated 21st of August 1950, argued that it was preferable to permit the turbulent political currents of that country to find their own level, even at the probable cost of an eventual deal between Vietnam and Viet Minh, and the spreading over the whole country of Viet Minh authority. This was Eisenhower's own feeling. He said he could not conceive of a greater tragedy for America than to get heavily involved. There's going to be no involvement, he repeated. If America did go in, it would only be in agreement with her principal allies and with explicit constitutional approval from Congress. He worked in the chiefs of staff and got from them the assurance, May 1954, that, quote, Indochina is devoid of decisive military objectives and the allocation of more than token U.S. armed forces to that area would be a serious diversion of limited U.S. capabilities. And then he goes on to why, in the process of government, this got lost. His final warning and final plea with America is to beware big industry and big military and their combination will destroy you as a democracy. But you see, it's worth reading and reviewing, and it's fun. The last chapter, he says, the big non-fact of this particular time has been the refusal of religion to disappear, even in the forms as you have it in Iran, where you've got a resurgence of Mohammedan fundamentalism that wants to go out and take the world by arms again, and the way it's minority majority of America. But he goes into more than that, and there's a real sense that you aren't through with the possibilities of being, as Paul Ricoeur puts it so well, being called to the new. His life lays hold of you with a new sense of astonishment that there is that impossible possibility. Freud loved those. I mean, Barth loved that phrase, and we use it a lot when it's up here, the impossible possibility that belongs to every act of the community that's in Jesus Christ. And believing that it can happen, as you stand praying, say amen. Remember? We'll close there. Just a little note of hope.
It's worth reading. You love it. This is history. Most of you are scared death of history, so I didn't mention it. It's fun.
The Heidegger is by a linguist who wrote the first article that caused a furor in America in 46 on the decay of language under Germany and how it had become defiled and had to be reborn. And of course, this is what Orwell's 1984 dealt with, as you recall. We have a defense department today, and Sunday created a defense department. Great guy. I oftentimes use him for an example around the church because I said his brother's got even better intelligence, and the church uses him to deal with all the tough cases in the ministry, namely Fritz Norstedt. But Lyle Norstedt set up a defense department. We used to have a Secretary of War.
He writes a lot for the New Yorker.
Yeah,
George Stone, yes, he does. Fine. But that's one of our new speak words, defense.